Right, if you would care to have open the chapter that we read from Genesis chapter 29. This is an interesting chapter if you look up in the commentaries, consulting them to try and find some help and advice as to what to preach from this chapter. One of them, which was published about 50 years ago, perhaps even 60 years ago, at the end of each section, the author has a small paragraph, homiletical tips or homiletical suggestions. And for this chapter, he says, well, everybody will have done this in Sunday school. There's nothing here that you can really preach about, so just ignore it. People learn from Sunday school, just skip over it onto the next one. I thought, well, that's really helpful. So I looked up another one. And at first I thought there were some pages missing from the book, but I counted the pages and they went 294, 295, 296, 297. So there were no pages missing, it's just this chapter is completely ignored in that book. So I looked at a few others and most of them seem merely to say what the chapter says. It doesn't try and give you any understanding or of the significance of anything that's in the chapter. So I conclude, at least from the commentaries I concluded, that the authors haven't got the faintest idea what can be preached from this chapter. Well, in perhaps 40 minutes' time, you might conclude that I haven't got much of an idea either, but we'll see how we get on. Firstly, to note that Jacob, having had his dream in chapter 28, did not stay at that place and say, oh, this is such a wonderful place, I'm going to stay here. He doesn't do that. Beginning of chapter 29, Jacob went on his journey. He carried on. Now, there are some people who form such close attachments to places where they have had particular blessings, they think, how can I possibly leave here after God has blessed me in this way? As we saw last week, what they're doing, they're making an idol of that piece of ground. And all idolatry is banned in Scripture. It's banned even of Bethlehem, of Nazareth, and of Jerusalem. We are not to make out that these places are any more special than this place is. God is just as much here with us now as he is with anyone who's now in Jerusalem. Even if they're standing at the foot of Golgotha, even if they're standing in the tomb, those places are no more holy than this place is. Because God has no special places in the world. You will not receive greater blessings by going to these places than by staying here. Because blessing comes directly from God. God does not mediate his blessings through things and through places. It is direct communication between God and the soul. I'm not saying there is no value in going to these places. If you want to understand the Bible, it's very useful going to these places. I would be very interested, for example, to go and find Ainon near Salim, which is mentioned in John chapter 3, because those who believe that baptism is by immersion say, but look, it says Jesus went to Ainon because there was much water. Well, obviously, he needed much water in order to immerse people. But what I have read, and I would love to check this, is that if you go to Ainon, there is not a great depth of water. The problem is that people have not correctly translated the Greek. The Greek, hudata pola, I'll be corrected afterwards for my pronunciation. The Greek words are hudata pola, which means many springs. And so it's got nothing to do with there being a great big deep puddle to immerse people in. It's got everything to do with the fact it was clean, running water. And John didn't want to use dirty water. So all you can argue from that is that you should use clean water for baptizing. And it doesn't prove that you should be immersed. But actually going there, you could see that. There's lots of other things in the scriptures. It would be useful to actually see the places because then you'd have a better understanding of the geography, of the setting, in order to understand what the scripture says. But it's in terms of understanding, not being able to say, Jesus himself stood on this spot. Oh, isn't this wonderful? Well, it won't do you any good at all. A lot of people think that, but it won't do you any good at all. Because blessing doesn't come from standing on the same spot that Jesus stood. Blessing comes directly from God. And we hope that that's what Jacob understood, and that's why he didn't sit around but day after day after day and saying, this is where God blessed me, so I'm going to stay here in case God blesses me again. No, he doesn't do that. He had been given a task by his parents, go to Haran, to the house of Laban, and there find a wife from his family. You're not to marry one of the local women. So he goes off, and when he gets near to Haran, he encounters this scene of a well with some sheep around it and some shepherds. Now, when I first read this, about a year after I was converted, I was trying to read things into everything I read. And I read this and I thought, this well is coming out of the side of a hill and the stone rolls this way across it. And so this obviously has some relation to Jesus' resurrection and the stone being rolled away. Now I look back on that now and I think, I was really stupid in those days. Well, it's true, I happily confess, I was stupid in those days. But you would be surprised about how many people have the same sort of idea. That's not what's going on here. This is a well. The characteristic of a well is that it's in the ground. And so you've got a hole in the ground, and often, not always, but often, if it's a long-established well, they will have built a wall around it to stop sand, soil, stones, other things falling into the well and blocking it up. It's the last thing you want in a hot country for your well to be blocked up. You've got to dig it all out again. So they would probably line the walls with stone to stop the soil, the sand, whatever it is, of coming in. And in order that there will be a continual ready supply of water. Now, not only do they not want the sand and soil to come in from the sides, but also, if you've been watching the news in recent years about the war in Iraq, you will know that the Americans, as they approached Fallujah, got hit by a sandstorm and they couldn't move. They had to wait for a day or two until the storm ceased. And the landscape can get changed quite a bit as the sand is shifted around. And large volumes of sand are moved. Well, obviously, if you have a well, the sand will get blown across and into the well, and the well will fill up. So what do? Any sensible person will say, cover it. You go into many houses, and you'll find that there is a jug. Indeed, you don't have to even go home. We have here some communion cups with communion wine in. And, oh look, they're covered over. Well, why are they covered over? Well, this building being what it is, there have been spiders climbing all over, and they've been making webs all over the place, and every now and again, bits will drop out of the webs. And we don't want bits from spiders' webs, or all other sorts of other things, dropping it into the communion wine because it might make us all very ill. So therefore we've covered it over. It's exactly the same sort of thinking. And so they've got a stone and they put it over the top of the well to keep things out. Stop animals falling in. So you get dead animals in the bottom. You don't want to drink water that's had a dead animal in it. Especially not a rotting animal. You want to keep the water clean and pure, otherwise you'll get ill and probably die from dysentery or something equally unpleasant. And you don't want just a bit of paper stuck over the top, because as soon as the wind blows, it's gone. Has to be a heavy stone. And they had here chosen a heavy stone that was so heavy it needed several people to lift it, which is why, as we read on, Jacob says, why aren't you watering the animals? And they said, we can't until all the other flocks have gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. This stone is heavy. It's difficult to move. We're waiting until everybody's here, then we move it, then everyone gets watered, then we move the stone back. And that's the way we do it, because the stone's so heavy. So Jacob obviously didn't understand this. He perhaps thought, well, this stone's not that heavy. Which says something about his own personal strength. But when he arrives and he meets these people, and he asks them where they come from, and they say, we're from Haran. So immediately he knows he's near his destination. And then he asks, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? Now, have you ever had the encounter of meeting an American? I had this experience a few years ago. I had an email from an American, and we were having a discussion. And he said, oh, now you live in England. Do you know Fred Bloggs? And I wrote back and said, no, where does Fred Bloggs live? Oh, he's not far from you. He lives in Newcastle. And I said, Newcastle's 50 miles away from here. He's, unless you mean Newcastle upon Tyne, in which case, add 200 miles to that distance. And in fact, he meant Newcastle on Tyne. Now, Americans might think that 250 miles is just down the road, and they do. You get some people who live right out in the wilds, and 250 miles, well, that's how far they drive to get their groceries every week. It's a completely different mentality. Well, you can look at a map and you can say, wow, that country's big. But until you've actually been there and driven some of these distances, you don't really get a full understanding of it. Having driven 4,000 miles when over there, I have a much better appreciation of just how enormous the place is. But that's by the by. But they say, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? Now, Haran was a big city, but a big city in those days was something about the size of Western Rim. And so it's therefore not surprising that when they say, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? They say, yeah, we know him. And some people in this village, you say, do you know so-and-so? And immediately they'll say, oh, yes. And they'll tell you where they live. They know everybody. Where there are others that say, well, I know my next-door neighbour, and that's about it. Some people are better at that than others. But they discover this, and then, having asked how he is, they say, look, here comes his daughter with her sheep. Because we discover that Rachel was a shepherdess. And so along she comes to water the animals. And obviously, Jacob is pleased to see her because this gives him the contact he needs with Laban. He was told to go and see Laban. But not only that, when he sees her coming, if you remember the old silly programs they had in the 60s, there was one I remember, we won't go into the details of it, but one young man in the program, almost every attractive woman that walked past, his eyes would sparkle. Well, you can almost imagine that's what's happened here. Jacob sees Rachel and his eyes sparkle. Now remember, Rachel is the niece of Jacob's mother. There was a lot of what we would today call inbreeding in those days, and people married quite close relations. And here we're going to discover that Jacob's going to marry cousins. Not allowed these days, but it was allowed then. And consequently, Rachel would look similar to her mother. My parents have a photograph in their living room of my grandmother, my father's mother. It was taken in about 1912. So she's wearing late Edwardian, early Georgian clothes. So big puffy arms, long skirt, big hat. And when you look at the photograph, you realise, or you think, it's my sister. She looks exactly as my sister looks. You would think that it was my sister dressed up in old clothes, and she's gone to one of these photographic places where you can dress up in old clothes and now take pictures of you. You can have fun doing that. But it's not. This is my grandmother. Spitting image of my sister. So, down through my father to my sister, you can see how the genes have gone. And so there is this very close family likeness. I look at pictures of my grandfather, both of them. None of them look like me. So I don't know where my looks have come from. Anyway, don't answer that. So it's quite likely that Jacob sees this woman, and what he's seeing is a young version of his mother. And all men love their mothers. And here, seeing a younger version of her, you can understand how his heart would go out to her just in seeing her. And we find then that Jacob, having moved the stone so that the sheep could be watered, Rachel comes along and he greets her. Verse 11, Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman, that he was Rebekah's son. Now, can you imagine someone, total stranger, out of the blue, comes up to you, embraces you, and kisses you, and you think, what on earth's going on here? I mean, most women these days would probably slap the person round the face, spray mace into his face, and get out their mobile phones and dial 999 and call for the police. Normally these days we do it the other way round. We say, this is who I am, and then, wow, and then the embraces. But Jacob did it the other way round. But Rachel obviously thought this was wonderful news, and she ran and told her father. However, obviously you can take this two ways, but I think it's obvious which way to take it. It's not, she ran to tell her father, saying, this weirdo's just come and embraced me and kissed me and claims to be my cousin. No, I think she took him at his word and was so delighted she ran to tell her father. Laban hears of it. This is my sister's son. I've not seen my sister for a very long time. One commentary I read was suggesting that it was 100 years earlier. Remember, they lived longer in those days. Jacob himself was about 60 at that time. So it's at least 60 years since Laban's seen his sister. We don't know if there'd been any communication with them. There were camel trains that passed between the two areas, but we don't know that they actually made use of them. Laban's delighted to meet Jacob and says, surely you are my bone and my flesh. We're related. We are of the same stuff. And as is said, another phrase, blood is thicker than water. An intimate blood relationship is the strongest that is known in the world. And Jacob stayed with Laban for a month. Now, during that month, I'm sure that Jacob didn't wake up in the morning, look at the clock, roll over and say, this is a nice comfortable bed, and just lie there and wait to be fed and watered by the servants of the house. No, I think Jacob would have been quite pleasant, he would have got up with everybody else, and he would have taken part in all the household duties, and would have helped out with the animals. And I think during this month, what happened was this. Laban observed Jacob and thought to himself, this man works well. This man is a good worker. This man works hard. This man would be an asset to me. And if Stephen Gerrard is worth £31 million to Chelsea, then how much is Jacob going to be worth to Laban? That's the sort of thinking that was going through his mind. I want this man to work for me. In the football world, you then get out your chequebook and you keep bidding up the price until you get the price that is agreeable to the other side. Laban's doing pretty much the same sort of thing here. He says to Jacob, right, you're my kinsman. Should you therefore serve me for nothing? Jacob had been working, hadn't got paid anything. Got his food, obviously. Didn't get anything else. Should you serve me for nothing? Tell me, what will your wages be? Now, I have a suspicion, it's not said, but I have a suspicion that Laban had not just observed Jacob's work, but had also had observed the sparkle in Jacob's eyes. And he thought, I can guess what he's going to ask for. And because of that, and if he really values her, he's going to set a high value on her in terms of a number of years he's prepared to work, and so I'll basically have a free labourer, in fact more than a labourer, a manager, someone who is worth a lot. But I'll let him set it because that will show how much he loves my daughter. And so Jacob says, okay, 7 years. Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel. It doesn't happen that way these days. What happens these days very often is that there's a late night phone call and the man speaks to his beloved's father and says, I'd like to ask for your daughter's hand in marriage. By the way, we got married last week anyway. Sadly these days it's more, even if you don't, we've just moved in together. But this is what we found with Jacob. Jacob says, I'll give you 7 years labour and it won't cost you anything. And Laban is content with this. And so then we have, and you must notice this when reading the scriptures, it's always important to read things carefully. Because you might think that verse 19, and suddenly Jacob's having children. No. Verse 20, Jacob served 7 years for Rachel. And they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. So this, suddenly we find a whole 7 years has gone past in the space of one verse. Always look for the timelines in a passage of scripture, because otherwise you could easily misunderstand. There is an excellent book that has been written called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings by Edwin Teeley. It's very well worth reading. And the update, because scholars for years had been saying, you can't rely on the Bible, it's full of inaccuracies. Look here, for example, it says in Kings, this happened on this date, and in Chronicles, it says the same thing happened on a completely different date. Well, if we read Calvin on the subject, I'm told that Calvin said, I can't reconcile these two dates. They seem totally incompatible. Perhaps there were two calendars. And Edwin Teeley published his book in 1950, 400 years after Calvin, and he shows that there were two calendars in use and two methods of calculating dates. And these are used almost interchangeably. And once you get to grips with these differences, everything fits into place perfectly. There's no disagreement between the passages. So observing dates, such as these 7 years here, is important to understand the flow of biblical history. But the 7 years are past. Jacob says to Laban, give me my wife, that I may go into her, for my time is completed. So they have a feast. And this wasn't the normal wedding breakfast. They made a feast that lasted quite a while, all day. They stuffed themselves. In the evening, Laban took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob. And he went into her. Now, we think about this and we think, how could Jacob be so incredibly stupid? Did he not know the difference between Leah and Rachel? Could he not tell which was which? There are a number of possible explanations here. One is that the feast lasted a long time and Jacob was drunk. It doesn't say that. Not impossible. Doubtless by the time the feast ended, it was dark. if it was the time, round about the time of the new moon, not a lot of light. We don't know how Leah and Jacob came together. Perhaps she had already gone into the tent and was lying there waiting for him. Perhaps she had used the perfumes that Rachel usually used. We're not told. I don't think Jacob was stupid. I think he was just deceived. It's interesting that just a few chapters back, Jacob had deceived his father and said, "Oh yes, I'm Esau," and had got the blessing instead. Now the boot's on the other foot, and Jacob is the one who's been deceived. Some people see this as Jacob getting his comeuppance. Well, I'm not sure whether we can say that or not. It might be the case, but Scripture doesn't say it. You always have to be careful about reading things into Scripture that aren't explicitly stated. It's a general principle. If it doesn't say it, perhaps it's not there at all. So we have to be careful. But certainly he did get his comeuppance, because when he woke in the morning and he rolled over and he saw this woman with the curlers in her hair and he said, "Hang on, you're not Rachel. What are you doing here? Where's my wife gone?" And of course, his wife wasn't there. And what he discovers is that he has married Leah. This is an interesting point. If that happened today, someone came here and got married and they went through and signed the forms, and then the next morning the husband wakes up to find it's one of the bridesmaids, he can say, "Hang on, I didn't marry you. It's not your name on the wedding certificate, so you can go and get lost. I want my wife." Here, Jacob's married Leah. He has had sexual relations with her. They're married. And when you read on, as we will, we find later in the chapter in verse 34, again, Leah conceived and bore a son and said, "Now this time, my husband." They were married. It's interesting to note the difference between modern marriage and marriage then. Having sexual relations was the equivalent of marriage. But also note, he also married Rachel. Polygamy, while it's not how God intended things from the beginning, yet we don't find it condemned anywhere in Scripture. We find Jesus saying that it was not so from the beginning. God made them male and female, one for one. But the only place where you get polygamy condemned is in 1 Timothy chapter 3, and there Paul says, "An elder shall be the husband of one wife." He doesn't say, you've got to get rid of all your wives. He says, if you have two or more wives, you cannot be an elder. An elder can only have one wife. And not do what David Livingstone is reported to have done, and that is that he would say to a chieftain who had become a Christian, he said, "You've got to get rid of all your wives except the first one." Which, if the play that was on the radio some years ago is to be believed, was a great pity, because he really loved the fifth one. Here, there is no condemnation upon Jacob for having married two women. In fact, he married four women, because he also had the two servants. So we should not be hasty about condemning people when we discover that they have more than one wife, as in some countries they do. If the Bible doesn't condemn it, why are we condemning it? What we can say is, this is not how God intended things to be, but the Bible doesn't say it must not be. So let's not say more than Scripture says. Let's say, this is the best. Why don't you strive for the best? Marry one woman and stick with her for life. Don't end up marrying half a dozen. But some people say two or more is far too much anyway. What man can cope with that many women? But I won't say that. So, within a week, and here you could argue that when people get married, they should not have a honeymoon for more than a week, because that's what Leah and Jacob had. They had a week Laban said, it is not done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also in return for serving me another 7 years. What? Another 7 years? But I didn't want her in the first place. But Jacob agrees. Jacob, it seems, has been developing a bit of honour and has decided, okay, it was 7 years for Rachel, 7 years for this one. And so he does that too. Jacob completes the week. Then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife, along with Bilhah, her servant. And so Jacob went into Rachel also and loved Rachel more than Leah and served Laban another 7 years. And notice again, it's the sexual relationship that establishes the marriage. Also notice, verse 30, Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah, which implies that Jacob loved Leah. In fact, when you read on to the following verses at the end of the chapter, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, and I think this is a relative term, she was loved, but nothing like as much as Rachel, God opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son, called his name Reuben. And then she had another son and called him Simeon. And another son and called him Levi. Another son and called him Judah. Four children, and this man hated this wife. I don't think so. He might not have loved her as much as he loved Rachel, but he clearly had a love for her. How on earth can a man have sexual relations with a woman he can't stand? Nonsense. He had sexual relations with Leah, and the consequence was, by the end of the chapter, four children. Now, I was going to go on and look at the names of the children of Jacob, but I think with the time as it is, we'll leave that for next week. And we'll just consider briefly some thoughts that have come out of this chapter. First thing is that in your dealings with people, remember human nature. Often you'll hear people say, when something unpleasant has happened, when they've been defrauded, they say, it really destroys your trust in human nature. To which you should always answer, you should never trust human nature. But surely people are basically good. No, people are basically wicked. That's how they are born. They are born sinners, they live as sinners. Some are greater sinners than others, but all are sinners. And some in their sin will deceive. Remember human nature when you make deals with people. This is why people produce contracts. You write out a contract where the duties and responsibilities of each party are laid down, and then you both sign it and say, this is how we're going to work the agreement. Now, hopefully, you never again need to look at the contract, because you just go on and you do what you've agreed to do. But because of human nature, things might go sour. And when they go sour, you hope they don't, but if and when they do, you need that contract to be able to say, look, this is what we agreed. And look, this contract also says, this is what happens if something goes wrong. And then can there be an amicable division between you? So what you don't want is to have to go to court over something and spend vast amounts of money really getting nowhere. I discovered on Friday how much it has cost the Sunday School Trust to evict those last tenants. In addition to the fact they didn't pay us a penny, we also had a bill for £4,000 for a barrister. So weren't they nice to us? You have to be careful always in case you get defrauded. Beware of human nature. Also, we can say from this, beware of buying a pig in a poke. You know what a pig in a poke is? you buy something unseen, being told it's one thing, and you get it home, and in fact it's another. Those of you that watch any of the auction programs that seem to be everywhere on the television these days, you go along to an auction, you bid for something, you pay a vast price for it, you get it home, and you open it up and you see in small letters printed inside it says, "Made in Hong Kong." And you realise it's a fake. You've been done. So you go back to say, "Look, it's a fake, I want my money back," and oh dear, they've gone. They've vanished. They're not there anymore. It's more likely would happen on a market stall. Beware of buying a pig in a poke. Rather, what you want is for the person you're buying it from or you're dealing with to let the cat out of the bag. These are related expressions. You're buying a pig in a poke, you're buying something in a sack unseen. But in fact it turns out not to be a pig, it turns out to be a cat, and oh dear, before you've actually paid the money over, the sack is open and out jumps the cat. Aha! You've let the cat out of the bag. Now I know this was a pig in a poke. That's where these sayings come from. Always beware of buying things. Check everything. Is it the egg card? Currently has an advert in which you have these two Dutchmen in an office and they're on the phone and saying, "Hello, you've won 20,000 euros, I forget the exact number, on the Hypo Euro Lottery. And all we require from you is 600 euros. Send us the 600 euros, we'll send you a check for £20,000. And then you get one of the Dutchmen saying, "There's one born every day." What stupid people. You know, I could be a billionaire by now, the number of offers that I've had over the last few years. The first one arrived on the fax from an oil company in Nigeria saying that as a result of various contracts, which sound a bit dodgy, that they had this excess of $16 million. And they wanted to get it out of the country. So they'd like to use me as a channel to launder this money. And the way to do this was that if I sent them all my bank account details with some headed notepaper with my signature on, they would then transfer the $16 million into my bank account, and then I would pass on all but 20% of that once they had come over to this country. And of course, what happened with anyone stupid enough to be taken in by this was you sent all the information, including the blank-headed notepaper, with your signature on the bottom. They would then type above your signature, "Dear Mr. Manager of this bank, the account details, please transfer all the money in this account into this other bank account." And the next time you went to get money out of your bank account, you discovered there was nothing there. I get about 5 of these a day. They're all now emails. I've responded to a few with another name, just to egg them on. It's entertaining for a while, but it does get a bit boring. You try and engage them in conversation and they're not interested. Give us the details. And of course, I'm not stupid enough to give them any details. But some people are. There is one story of a man, he poured thousands into this, he'd mortgaged his house again, and they had a meeting with him in the Hilton Hotel in London. And they said, "Right, now, here is the money." And there was this great big pile of money sitting on the table. It was all black paper. They said, "This is the only way we could have got it out of the country. We've had to specially treat it with chemicals to hide the fact that it's money. That's why it's black. But we have this special chemical here. And look," took one of the pieces of paper, "look, we wash it in this chemical and look, it's a $100 bill. And we can sell you some of this chemical for another £20,000. The man hands the money over. They shake hands. The crooks leave. For some reason, they always seem to be Nigerians. But they leave, and then the man says, great, this is wonderful. So he takes the first pile of notes and starts to wash it, and washes it, and washes it, and it's just blank paper. He's got a pile of blank, black paper. Remember human nature. Don't be taken in. Check everything, but don't get paranoid. We've had some inquiries about future use of the Sunday school. There's at least two organisations that need to relocate and have expressed interest. And someone speaking on behalf of one of the organisations spoke to me yesterday. I said, had he seen the website? He said, no, I'm not on the internet. It's bad enough having my phone bugged by MI5. And my first thought was, oh dear, we've got a loony here. In fact, he turned out to be a lovely gentleman, but he does seem to be a bit paranoid. Don't get paranoid. Don't see, as it used to be said when the Soviet Union was still alive, don't see reds under the bed everywhere. Just be careful. Remember human nature. Remember Laban tricked Jacob. It's not impossible that you might be deceived as well. But also remember the providence of God, because in the providence of God, these people involved in this story are the ancestors of Christ. In fact, if you look at the genealogy of Jesus, who was he descended from? He was not descended from Rachel. He was descended from Leah. Judah was his ancestor. Judah was the fourth son of Leah. And just because it doesn't talk about God's providence here, doesn't mean we cannot see God's providence here. Read the book of Esther. You read through the whole of Esther from cover to cover. God is not mentioned once. Now this caused some people a great problem, and they thought, oh dear, well, we'd better rectify this. And they wrote additions to Esther. And if you look at the Roman Catholic Bible, that's what you'll be reading, their additions. In which, at almost every turn, Esther gave thanks to God. Got on her knees and prayed. And it's God this, God that, God the other. It was a bit over the top. Because they thought they had to improve upon what God had already said. So if you have a Roman Catholic Bible and you find it saying things that the normal Bible doesn't say, it's because it's a Roman Catholic one to which they've added things. But God was still there throughout the book of Esther, overruling, just as he was here. Notice also that even though there are some dodgy dealings going on here, yet God was working in and through these people, and they knew some blessing from God. And so even when we sin through ignorance, yet in spite of that, blessing can come. It doesn't justify sin. Sometimes we do the wrong thing for the right reason. Blessing can still come then. It's not an excuse for doing the wrong thing. We should make sure that we're doing the right thing for the right reason. But it can be a great comfort after you've done the wrong thing to discover that God can still bless you despite of that. Which also reminds us of God's grace in dealing with us. God deals with us in grace. We're saved by grace. We live by grace. We're saved because of grace, not because of our goodness. These people, when we read all the things they've done, could not be described as good. And when you say, well, what about Rachel? Well, later on we'll discover a bit more about Rachel's character. And we'll see quite clearly that Rachel was not good. But God, nonetheless, blessed these people. Isn't God good? And we're about to have a reminder of that in the Lord's Supper. So here is a chapter that some commentaries say is not worth preaching on. And yet still there are things in here that we can learn and which are valuable to us. One day perhaps we'll do the early chapters of 1 Chronicles, which is just a long list of people's names. And I think we'll find in going through that we will discover some blessing. It's a bit more difficult than this chapter, but even so, there is blessing to be found in all of Scripture, even though some is of greater blessing and benefit than others. Well, let's give thanks to God for his word that he has given to us.